There's this saying that businesses are bought and not sold.
So that phrase, businesses are bought, not sold, is complete garbage. Businesses which are of value are sold every single day. So the idea of being passionate is massively overrated at the beginning. The hardest part of being a CEO is that you don't know what you don't know. There's a thing that I always say, is like, you create yourself, you don't find yourself.
Yeah.
And I think so many people, especially in business, are like trying to
find.
And then at this point, I'll be ready. And it's interesting, right? Because having a business partner is like a marriage, right? Yeah. And you don't just propose first date.
When you started Fan Bites, did you lead with your heart or did you lead with your head?
I led with my pocket because the company got bigger and I got less passionate about the things I was doing.
This is The Startup Leap, where we explore the stories of incredible entrepreneurs who have taken the leap to build their own startups.
Get ready for real, raw, and relatable discussions, nuanced conversations that unearth insights into the realities and possibilities as you explore taking the leap to starting your own company.
We're your host.
I'm Maria, operator to an investor and partner at OpenSeed VC.
I'm Yvonne, an early stage tech investor and partner at Local Globe.
And welcome to the Startup Leap.
Yvonne and Maria are partners at Local Globe and OpenSeed VC, respectively. Local Globe and OpenSeed are independent of the Startup Leap podcast. Any statements made by Maria, Yvonne, or the Startup Leap guests are solely their view and are not advice. Endorsements by the Startup Leap, its guests, Maria and Yvonne.
So Tim, in the midst of being a student at university, you decided to start your business.
And while other students were studying.
Yes. And one of the things that you've said is you don't believe that you actually have to have a passion before you start a business, right?
Oh, we're going there.
And so when you started Fan Bites, did you lead with your heart or did you lead with your head? Tell us, how important was the passion behind?
I led with none of them. I led with my pocket.
Okay, so tell us more.
I basically saw a market opportunity in the influencer world and I thought, all right, cool, we're going to capitalize on it. So I think that the idea of being passionate is massively overrated at the beginning. I became quite passionate about it, I'll say, in year three. If I was to think about the waves of passion I had for Fan Bites, it probably went no real passion, market opportunity, and then a bit of passion. And then basically like year five, I was like less passion because the company got bigger and I got less passionate about the things I was doing.
Mm.
And so you wasn't driven by passion. So it was the opportunity rather that drove you.
Yeah, I think the opportunity, the money that was possible. And then I think halfway through, it was more like the competition.
Right.
So I started off by thinking, oh, this is a good way we could build a business that we could sell.
Mm.
And then halfway through, I thought, oh, actually, we could win this market.
Mm.
And I got driven by competing against other people in the agency space.
So you started with the idea to sell in mind. So
from the
beginning. Was that something you did with that startup or had you done that before? Because I know you sold a startup before.
Yeah, so I think, so the business I sold before, Entrepreneur Express, bear in mind, we're using the word like sold. It was only for like 110 grand.
Yeah.
But
it was sold.
Yeah, I mean, it was sold.
It was sold.
And
how old were you at that point in time?
I was 17 then.
That's
right?
That's a lot of money for a 17
like,
year old.
At that point, it was almost like, wow, that's incredible. Now, did that inform the way that I thought about business in the subsequent business? I say yes, because it made my eyes open to the fact that you could just think about something.
Mm.
And then at some point, someone will pay you more money than you thought was possible. And I just thought, wow, this is an unbelievable game, right? And I think if I hadn't had that prior experience, I still would have started a business to sell, but I don't think I'd have believed in it as much.
Okay, so we're going to get back into the whole exit because I think that's like super interesting. But like take us back earlier into your childhood, your early beginnings. What were the things that really shaped who you are as an entrepreneur? I mean, obviously Fan Bites was your third business.
Yeah.
Take us back to the first.
You started early. You started really early.
Yeah. So I started my first ever company at 14. Mm-hmm. I think that big desire was because I just wanted to do something slightly different.
Mm.
So the story actually goes that I did a bet with a friend of mine where we bet each other, like, will we see, who would see 500 pounds before we turn 18? And basically the bet was, all right, cool. we'll see who can do it. And I just decided that the way to do it would be to start a tutoring business. And off the back of that tutoring business, of getting 65 tutors, connecting them as the middleman, I was like, wow, this is amazing. Off the back of that, that spark in my head of, wow, this is something that I could just do, was what was ignited. What's really funny, actually, is I started this year, I started taking therapy.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And my therapist, actually, when I wrote down my bio, my therapist was like, you know, you talk a lot about your exits being quite a defining moment for you. Mm. But I think a bigger defining moment for you was starting a company at 14. Mm. And she was right. She's always right. She was right, because what she was saying was like, that gave me that little bit of confidence to know that I could do something. And then at 17, then starting Entrepreneur Express and selling it for what really is like a very small sum, but a big sum for a 17-year-old. It just like increased the flame a little bit more. And which therefore, I think when at 21, when I started Fanbyte, I just had this sense of, well, duh, this is obviously going to happen.
Yeah.
So the 14-year-old business was, to some degree, a lot more significant than the 27-year-old exit.
It was what kickstarted, exactly. I guess, that domain. And would you say you did anything different as you kind of went through each business? Think about it. Like, for the first, what did you do in the second that you definitely did?
Yeah.
The first and the third, second.
So the tutoring business failed because, basically, I was the middleman connecting two people, right? Mm-hmm. People who needed tutors to people who, to the tutees, right? Tutors, tutees. And the reason why I failed was because, basically, as with any physical middleman business, when I connect someone, they just go behind my back.
Disintermediation.
Exactly. Yeah, like, there's no reason for you to come back.
Yeah.
Especially if it's tutoring and you really like your tutor. So the big change that I did to the second business was that I became the person who owned the audience. So Entrepreneur Express was basically an online business publication. But the way that I drove traffic through was through like Facebook pages and all that stuff. But the big thing was like I owned the media rather than being the middleman. Now, I did become the middleman when I went to advertisers and I got them to basically advertise in my blog and stuff. But I got a bit more of the value.
Right.
And then in the third business, Fanbyte, you would think it's a classic middleman business, right? Because like you're connecting brands to influencers. Mm-hmm. But having learned from the first and the second one was, how do we add more value at like as a company? So that's when we added like insights and technology and data and all that stuff, which made it seem more than just, hey, we have a bunch of emails of influencers, but actually we are a one-stop shop for the full service of you being able to run influencers. So that's basically what I learned from each stage.
I mean, 14 is very young to start a business. I know you said that it was a bet with your friend, but just looking back on your childhood, were there any moments that you felt sparked that entrepreneurship spark within you?
Yeah, so I think there's two big moments. The first one was being sent to Ghana before I was 6 months old. So I was born here in Hackney, but then I got sent to Ghana to live with my grandma, and I stayed there for 10 years. And I think coming back here, I had this feeling of like, who am I? And I need to give some, and I need some kind of significance in my life. And so for me, doing business was a way of driving that significance. And then actually the second thing was, so Entrepreneur Express was started when I was 17. But at 17, I had, well, I guess at 16, I had just joined a sixth form, like a boarding school private sixth form. And everyone there was insanely clever. So I'd gone from basically like a state school where I was the big dog and I was like the smartest person to then being surrounded by geniuses. And I think at that point also, I had this feeling of, right, I need to prove myself in some way.
Yeah, like, differentiate yourself.
Yeah, exactly, right? Because I can't compete with, you know, like Luke and Francis and Sam, who are basically like, they have got 100% in further maths at 15. It's like, what do I do here, you know? And so when you realize that, like, you either say, I'm either going to compete or I'm going to, like, change the game completely.
Right. Yeah.
And so this was the reason why, I think, in Christ Hospital, I was like, okay. Christ Hospital was the name of the school. In Christ Hospital, I was like, okay, I'm going to win this business game, because, like, all you nerds don't want to win that game.
The entrepreneurship was your edge.
That exactly, was your right? Exactly. USP, okay. And they didn't like it. I remember the day after Entrepreneur Express. No, I remember whilst I was running Entrepreneur Express, I ended up basically being able to do an interview in a single day with like Richard Branson, James Caan, and Alan Sugar. Mm. And I came back to the school. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I was like showing pictures and people were like, okay. Like
jealousy was creeping
jealousy
in.
Jealousy was creeping God. In. And the jealousy was creeping in primarily because it was almost like I was doing something that they hadn't even thought was possible.
Yeah. Mm.
To them, it was like, go to school, go to Oxbridge. Yeah. A ton of them went to Oxbridge, right? But actually, like, deep inside, they were right. Like, I don't want to just do the conventional path. And here was this guy who had basically come into the school a year before and had done all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Fan Bites, minute, what was the USP at the time? What did you see in the solution that you kind of proposed at the time?
The solution, okay, so the USP changed over time, but we saw the wave of social media influencers.
So you used a market trend as the first thing.
Exactly. Okay. So we saw the wave of social media influencers rising and rising and rising. I had studied and like read enough about marketing where I realized that in any new industry, there's always like an independent wave. So there were a bunch of, when TV became very popular, all right, we now need to just have TV marketing companies. Yeah. And then over time, it ends up being like a consolidation. So like a big company that owns TV and radio and PR and podcast. So my whole thing was, wow, there is a big trend going on in the world of social media influencers. Mm. I'm part of the audience who are being influenced by these social media influencers. And if I'm part of this audience, then that means brands will want to spend a ton of money to tap into that. We don't even need to be number one. We just like need to be
follow
in
the
market
wave, and the market will take you.
So there were so many times during Fan Bites, I would say to my co-founders and my team and our investors, I'd be like, you know, we don't have to win, we just have to not die, right? Because like this market is gonna grow.
The tailwind is so strong, like the market, you know, tailwind.
And if we are like in the top 10 companies in the UK, we will win, right? Yeah. So that was the way that I thought about the business opportunity.
Interesting. Did you, what was the distance between when you graduated from?
I started in my second year of university.
Interesting.
Talk to us about that.
Wow.
How do you manage a business as a student?
Oh, it's easy. Just do it.
Really?
Yeah, like, it's not hard.
Okay.
It's just not
hard. People would argue that it is, because then you have to, something has got to give. What do you think gave? Like, if you have to go to class. Now we're talking. So you have to kind of, but
here's
graduated.
A really funny thing.
And because I guess like a lot of people talk about like college dropouts, like Mark Zuckerberg dropped out of university. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like,
you didn't drop out.
You didn't drop out. You
I
decided
didn't drop
to continue.
Out, but the reason that I didn't drop out was because I felt, so I felt like I had to finish it for my parents, especially my dad. So my dad, unfortunately, had been ill. He'd had a stroke whilst I was in university. Actually, no, in sixth form. And then he had unfortunately, he had a fatal stroke when I was in university. Mm. And I always had this kind of feeling of, I should complete this for him. Mm. And when it really came down to it, though, like, I knew in my heart that I wasn't ever going to really use the degree.
Yeah, but you did it anyway. Yeah. Almost like a principles or like
something just as
more
principles.
Internal.
But it's quite funny. Like in the third year of uni, I think I was actually in university. Like I actually saw this email from my, what's it called? Your head of department being like, do you know that you've only been in class for like 17 days or something? It was mental. Because
so
I was always
classes.
In London.
Yeah, of course. Like, something has to give it. But it's incredible that you still were able to do both, actually.
Yeah, yeah. But it's almost, I don't know, man. Like, there was no other option, right? Like, people often...
I think you think of things differently when you know you don't have a choice.
Exactly.
You stretch and you meet what it's asking of you and
you
do
it. You make it happen.
Yeah.
Like, people talk a lot. I'm okay, I don't know. Maybe I get canceled for this. But, like, people talk a lot about, like, oh, I've got a job, but I want to start a business and I'm finding it like difficult. And I'm like, well, it's meant to be difficult.
It's a feature of the bug. I say this, it's like, that's the design.
Yeah, so what are you going to do? Like, what do we do here, right? And so for me, I think that's a very important thing that I just saw it as hard and then I just did it.
Right.
One question I have is just around like finances. So a lot of immigrants and especially people from like humble backgrounds, like, when they're thinking about making the leap, they have to consider, like, how do I live? One of the benefits I think you have is the fact that you started very early. So I almost feel like you kind of had that muscle of high risk, like not having to think about too many dependencies on you. And maybe I'm wrong, but tell me if it's about that. Like, the traditional route for most people is, oh, I'm in school, I just need to finish, you know, get a degree, get a stable job that gives me an income, you know, get a good credit score, like get a good, like that obviously, like the risk to you wasn't. So tell me a bit about that. Do you think it's your upbringing? Do you think it's just personality? Like, why are you able to make those leaps, like, and not really think out? Maybe you thought about it, but it'd be great to chat a bit about that.
So I think the two biggest things that shaped my attitude to money whilst running my business was, number one, doing it young.
Yes, I had
zero commitment. I could work from anywhere. I could do whatever. But number two, which to me is even more important, was the type of business that we chose. Mm. I intentionally didn't go for some, like, we need to raise millions of funding business in order to succeed. I chose a business which at the beginning was just like a services business. Mm-hmm. And we were profitable. And then what I then ended up doing while I was raising money was doing it for a very specific purpose. Mm. And I think the reason why so many people put themselves in a lot of like financial angst is because they choose a business which needs them to raise a lot of money, and then they go, oh no, I need to fundraise for this, when really, especially if it's your first or second business, doing something with pretty low cost where you can get started
revenue quickly
is very important.
Interesting.
So it sounds like you were really intentional around the type of business you started.
Yeah, I had one goal in life in my 20s or in my early 20s, because I'm still 20. My one main goal was like, all right, before 30, I basically want to have more money than I ever know what to
Where did that come from?
It came from being a poor kid. Like, that was it. Like growing up on Old Kent Road, I was like, you know what's so interesting, right? So I was talking to my friend about this, which was, so I grew up like fourth floor council estate on Old Kent Road, and we didn't have a lift. Mm-hmm. And I always remember certain times coming home when it was like dark outside and like running up the stairs and just saying to myself, like, I don't belong here. I don't belong here. Like just like shouting to myself, I don't belong here. I don't belong here. And so I like internalized that to myself. And I think I just gave myself a self-image of someone who this was just a pit stop. Mm. And I believed in that so much. That almost like, you know, when we sold the business and people asked me, like, did you think it would happen? I was like, well, yeah. Because it's like exactly how I planned it. Like, I said, I'll do this, then I'll do this, then I'll do this, then I'll do this. And then I did it, right? Yeah. But I think that came because, like, as a kid, I just had this, like, very big sense of self-belief, which came from not having much and thinking I was, like, I was designed to do something different. Mm. So that probably is where it came from. And to be honest, I think a lot of people have that.
Yeah.
But they feel like they need to be special in order to have that. So I get this a lot from people who say, follow me on social. They might say something like, oh, that's good for you because you had this. And I go, I had what?
Exactly. And then
they go,
like,
oh, because, you know, you discovered social media early. Okay. But, like, you could have also discovered social media early. And, like,
so it's like people believe they need to have something special, but it's like there. This, yeah, it's like self, like this, you create exactly. it.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. You create yourself, right? There's a thing that I always say, it's like, you create yourself, you don't find yourself.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think so many people, especially in business, are like trying to
find yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like, and then at this point, I'll be ready.
Yeah, and
right?
Like, yeah, never.
And it never comes, right? You have to almost like
They postpone themselves.
Yeah.
They postpone themselves. Like, don't postpone yourself. Because if you postpone yourself, you keep postponing, then you'll be like, I don't know, 70 and be like, okay, and then I'm going to feel ready.
Yeah, and it's like, nah. Yeah. It's so. Did you ever feel peer pressure? Like, because I'm just thinking, really, no. Like, you're. It's almost like you're living a life that's not the traditional, like, 18-year-old. So you probably had friends. Probably they looked like they were doing well. Like, did you ever, at some point, especially when it wasn't yet glamorous, like, found by 21, being a CEO at 21, like, having to think about payroll at 21.
So I felt peer pressure for 1 week.
Really?
1 week.
What week was that?
It was actually. Spring week.
Well,
so
okay.
like for people who don't know, so Spring Week is when in universities, like the banks and all those guys come in and like, you know, you can work for us, etc.
Yeah.
I felt peer pressure because actually quite a few of my friends, they were like, oh yeah, I've got this from Goldman. I've got this
exactly.
Like, but then I was like, I don't want that. But I did feel a peer pressure, which was a sense of, well, they're doing it. They seem happy doing it. And I'm like, and I want that happiness that comes from that. And then I was like, yeah, I just don't want that. And that exercise of like, what do I want is a useful mental exercise.
I love that.
To help you to make these decisions.
And the truth I actually believe is that you know what you want. It starts with what you don't want, actually. Ironically, sometimes you do it by elimination. You're like, that doesn't sound good. I have a similar experience where, like, I was in consulting and I would look at the partners and I would be like,
I don't want that. No.
It's great for them, but I'm just like, and everyone's like, oh, that you're doing so, I'm just like, no. So I feel like you, there's something in you that actually knows what you want sometimes more than you realize.
Yeah. That's a very good way of thinking about it, which is almost... negative goals, right? Which
exactly. Like, it's like, I don't, if you don't want to do
what
that,
don't I want?
Eliminate. Because that's what you said with Goldman Sachs. You're like, oh, for a little bit there, you're like, I wanted that.
Yeah.
Like, actually, no, I don't.
Yeah. One of the things that influenced me was I got fired from my first ever job because I outsourced it.
That is so on brand. Like, that is so typical of an entrepreneur.
That's quite funny.
Very smart, man.
Yeah. And I think going through that, you know, that week that I felt peer pressure, I was just like, you couldn't even stay in a job for 3 days selling crisps. Sure. That was the job. It was like selling crisps. And I outsourced and I gave it to my friend to do it, and then they found out. And it was like, you couldn't even do that for 3 days selling crisps. And you think you lost a week in Goldman.
Yeah,
come on, man. So, yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about being a CEO. So, obviously, you're a relatively young CEO, right?
Yeah.
And the company grows, evolves, and scales.
Yeah.
How did you evolve as a CEO and grow with the company?
So I think the hardest part of being a CEO is that you don't know what you don't know.
Mm.
And for the 5-6 years that we ran FanBite, it was just a perpetual hamster wheel of every day realizing, oh, I didn't know this. Right. Oh, I didn't know this. And that can either break you or that can make you. And I changed my identity to be someone who was constantly learning rather than thinking I was constantly failing. Right. I think that distinction there really helped me. Because I speak to so many other founders, and I'm sure you do as well, where it's like they feel like they're failing because something has happened in their business.
Yeah, it's like,
because you've never done it before. Yeah. So like I'm 3 months ago, I started learning to swim, right?
Okay.
And there were a few things, like, you know, just basic front crawl. And I was like, how is this person doing it? And
exactly. I'm not doing it, right?
And for maybe like 5-10 minutes, I'm like, oh man, I can't do this. And then I thought to myself, I have never done this. Exactly. I'm not meant to know how to do this, right? So beating up myself and thinking that I'm failing at swimming doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Similarly, when you have a bunch of founders who are like, I feel like a failure because we haven't raised the round in a month.
Like, and you're like, oh, okay.
You've never raised money.
Yeah.
So therefore, you don't feel like a failure. You're learning from that.
Yeah.
So that was the
that reframing. Yeah.
Thing
yeah.
I had to do as a CEO.
Okay. And let's talk about a little about the team, right? And so obviously you had 2 co-founders.
Yes.
How did that come about?
I met Ambrose at a leadership event. Okay. It was actually by the Powerlift Foundation.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, Veronica and Ken Olisa.
Mm-hmm.
I met them at a leadership event. We were just sitting next to each other randomly, and Ken has this, and we tell this story a lot. Ken basically said, you know, you could be sitting next to your business partner, look to your left, look to your right. And
Ambrose tells me this,
and Ambrose tells me this story a lot, and I think it's categorically true, which was like, he looked at me and he was like, no way is this guy gonna be a co-founder. Because I think like everyone had come in like suits and stuff, and I'd come in just like a t-shirt and some blue trousers, you know.
Rebel.
And he said, "Yeah, being a bit of rebel." And he said, yeah, there's no way. Then we made friends. We bonded over books. We bonded over a whole range of things. A lot of like personal stuff as well, like books from Ghana, et cetera, et cetera. Mitchell, I met because I asked my friend, I was like, who is the best technical person that you know? Because basically, I kind of realized FanBytes, if we wanted it to be like the type of exit that we wanted, it would have to not be something that we valued based on EBIT.
Right.
And so we'd have layer technology on top of it so that we could tell like a value. Revenue.
Yeah, yeah. How far into the journey did you come to that realization?
I finished reading a book called Built to Sell in my second year.
In uni? Or in, sorry, second year in FanBytes.
I'm actually trying to think, actually. No. So, fun story. This is a very good story for your audience. So, when FanBytes started, we thought it'd be like a SaaS business. We
really?
Thought it'd be pure SaaS.
Okay.
Right? Because we saw, again, the wave of social media influencers.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, well, we're going to build a SaaS tool for brands to be able to tap into it, right? And also, it's all SaaS, right? Yeah. You know, get the multiples high. And then the government reached out to us to do a minimum wage campaign. And they said, we'll pay you, I think it was like 100 grand or something.
Yeah.
But we want you to manage the whole thing.
Mm.
So, oh, man, like we can't say no to 100 grand.
We'll do it.
Like, guys, we are an agency.
I love the flexibility, though. It's like going where the customer is. Like, yeah, there's that element of what you want to build, but then there's an opportunity. How do you kind of leverage that?
And we're also like, so, because we've done like previous campaigns, like £300 campaigns here, et cetera, but they weren't ever like significant. They were all like, yeah, use our software, and then like really we're in the back doing the work.
Yeah.
Right? So that pivot then, to kind of being an agency, I was like, we still need to get the, like, the revenue story.
Yeah.
So let's use tech to help us to scale.
Mm.
So that was how I met the two co-founders. Okay. I met Ambrose first, and we worked on a bunch of different stuff together, and then I brought on Mitchell.
That working on a bunch of different stuff together, was it deliberate or not? Because another part is, like, you meet someone, you get on, and then you're like, well, do we work well together?
Yeah.
This is a long-term
thing. So it's so interesting. That's an excellent question. Because actually, it was accidental, but now for any business I do, I'm like intentional.
Yeah.
Like we have to work on something else together.
Yeah.
We have to. And it's interesting, right? Because since we sold the business, there's been a few times where I've like wanted to start something with someone.
Yeah.
And then I've had to check myself and say, you know what? Yeah. Let's work on something small.
Yeah.
And in working on that something small, I realized I don't want to work with you.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's very, very important, right? Because I'm sure you've heard of this whole thing about how, like, having a business partner is like a marriage, right?
Yeah.
And you don't just propose first
date. Kinda
you date a bit, right? And I think that's very, very, very important. So many people, and I could have got that wrong quite a few times, but accidentally I got it right.
On the conversation of people, so when you started at FanBytes, was the three of you, then obviously you grew the business and hired...
about 80 people by the time.
80 people. Talk to us a little bit about how you viewed hiring. You know, what are the key things that you looked for when you're hiring a team and scaling the business? As it's one of the hardest things when building
especially
a company.
Especially also, you haven't hired at that scale before, exactly. I imagine.
So I think I was a terrible manager at the beginning. And I think by the time we sold, I was less terrible, but I was still terrible.
I mean, love the authenticity.
And the reason why is when I was getting into business, you know, I'd read books about Steve Jobs and all those people. Mm. And I basically equate that the way to win is by being, right?
Yeah, I don't know
that
if Steve Jobs is a good example.
Yeah.
Because he was.
Yeah.
He was a tyrant.
Yeah.
And I was then like, oh, yeah, like the way you win is by being like, you should do this now, and you know, and that's the way you lose. And
how long did it take you to learn that?
It took me about 3 years.
Okay.
And the big one was when like several great employees were leaving.
Mm.
So, well, I think this is my fault.
Yeah.
So to hire, I think the first one is to like shirk your ego.
Yeah.
That was something that I did a lot where I wanted to be right.
Yeah.
And so because I wanted to be right, it was like I didn't give the space for other people
to
just input. And then the second thing is actually truly realizing the role of a CEO. I got that wrong. Until we started to hire some like really credible people, I think I got that wrong, where basically I thought that the questions and the answers needed to come from me.
Every time. It's a common mistake. Yeah.
Everyone, right? Mm. But really, I remember I had a friend say this, and it's always stuck with me, which is that a CEO is almost in like the people collecting business.
It is.
Mm-hmm. And I was like, man, that's such a good way to frame it. And so those were two mistakes I made, I think, at the beginning, and to be honest, till the end, where I just thought, man, if only you knew.
Yeah.
But, you know, then I'm not going to do that for the next business, right?
Cool. Amazing. Now, take us back to FanBytes. So you set out building the company knowing that at some point you would want to sell it, right?
Yeah.
And there's this saying that businesses are bought and not sold. Talk to us a little bit about how you went about the whole exit journey. Yeah. And from the very beginnings, when you started that company, knowing that you wanted to sell it at some point, what are some of the decisions you made?
Great question.
Based on that decision that was going to come later on down the line.
So, all right. So just going to that. So, how do I phrase this? Yeah. So that phrase, businesses are bought, not sold, is complete garbage.
Mm-hmm.
Because businesses are sold every single day. And it's businesses which are of value are sold every single day.
Mm.
So I'll come back to that. So what were some of the steps that we did to increase us being able to sell? Number one, we didn't raise a lot of money. In all, we raised 2 million. We had the opportunity to raise 10 million, and I said no. The reason why is because I knew that if we raise a lot of money, we'd have to sell at a pretty high valuation. And I didn't think
FanBytes would.
Number two.
Let me interject there. Did you have a value in mind that you wanted to sell for?
I wanted a value that personally I would
was
have.
Meaningful to you.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. I didn't really care too much about what the overall value of the business was. What I did know was that it wasn't like a $100 million business.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And you were honest with yourself about that.
Yeah.
Why do you think you were? Because, you know, most of the time entrepreneurs are like so enamored by what they're building and they're like, oh, this is the next best. You're like, no, it's not the next best thing, but it's great. It's like it solves a problem.
So I think there's probably two things. One is I'm quite a logical person.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just like, well, if you do this and you do this, done. The other thing is that I just read a lot about how companies are valued.
Mm.
Right? I obsessed over basically, you know, MBA books, M&A books.
Ah.
And so I'd go, oh, okay, well, they did this revenue. They did this EBIT. They had this. Okay, well, that makes sense. Because I agree with you, like, sometimes I'm talking to one person who's got some social aggregation app, and and they say, oh, and this is how we're going to get to $1 billion. Like, what crap are you smoking? Like, what drug is it that you're high on to think, like...
That you believe it.
That you believe it. And I'm like...
Well, some could say it's, like, ambition. Some could say, like, you're just, like...
Yeah, no, it's delusion. It's delusion. There's ambition and there's delusion.
Thin line, most exactly.
Like...
Why do you think, what possess you to think this? And I think this sometimes with so many founders, I'm like, just get a spreadsheet, get a sheet of paper, just like run the numbers.
Yeah.
Right? Mm. Anyway, so we didn't raise a ton of money. We also left a lot of meat on the bone. So here's what I mean by that. Some people aim to sell their business when they have completely exhausted all the potential value.
I see.
Whereas in FanBytes' case, I was like, okay, well, we're making tens of millions in revenue. And we have 40% of our revenue coming from the US.
Mm.
What people would then say is, right, let's go dominate the US. Mm. What I said was, we're not going to go to the US. Because when eventually we want to then sell the company... There's a complete great narrative of saying, well, actually,
started, but then you can continue this.
You can run it up, right?
Yeah.
Because you have people in the US, you have a big team in the US, et cetera, right? And that narrative was definitely one that really landed. And so often when I'm speaking to founders or just friends and they're running their companies and they're like, okay, so this is how we're going to exit, et cetera. I say, all right, so let's create a chart and let's say like this is the peak, this is world domination. What does this bit look like? For those who aren't listening, basically I've pointed up and I've pointed down. but like what is 70% of world domination? 60,
look like what does that look like?
And let that be your goal. Because then
you don't want to sell at the peak. Right.
It makes no sense.
And the value is in there. It's so funny. Also, I almost feel like sometimes you actually don't know the potential of a business because the market evolves as you go. You literally can't predict. I don't think Facebook knew it was going to be what it is. Like, you have the instinct and you have some kind of short-term or long-term, but it's not really what the it will become. So, yeah, that's super interesting.
Here's a really interesting insight. By the time we sold the business, I think the biggest ever deal we'd done was like $500,000, right? I caught up with some of the people who still work there now. Brain Labs, the company that bought FanBytes, through FanBytes have done £6 million deals. Like six individual deals, which are worth £1 million. We didn't even get anywhere close to that. But the reason why is exactly as you said, just like, we just didn't understand how to get like £1 million pound deal, right? And then you have Brain Labs, a 900-person company who
Brain Labs
is used
acquired.
To, yeah.
Why do you think they did? Like, what was the core strategic reason they did?
So, in the exits, we had four companies put in... Well, so we had three companies. Actually, this would be super interesting for listeners. So, do you want us to go through, like, the process from exits? Or, like, from the start? Okay, so... Right, so... We started off by, I kept getting emails from people who were interested in integration, right? Okay. And at any point, that basically means, yo, let's buy you.
oh, really? Is that the code word? It's like, we want to integrate.
Or partnership.
A partnership.
Let me take a step back, because you knew from the beginning that you wanted to sell the business at some point. Yeah. And like, I always say, like, some of the greatest entrepreneurs I know of, they almost know who they could potentially sell to very early on. Did you have an idea of like who you could potentially sell to?
Or the profile of, or like the kind of
So I knew the type of profile.
Okay. Did you set out to build those and forge those relationships?
Yeah. So this is a wonderful question. So accidentally. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is basically whilst I was running FanBytes, we had a lot of like PR and press.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Industry press, trade press. And so that actually built up our name over time. Now, if I could do it again, or in my next business, I'll be super intentional. I would like have my list of people, make friends with them, you know, build relationships, and then at some point do that. But in terms of how the exit process started, I basically, in 6 weeks, I got emailed by three different companies who were interested in partnering up.
What happened? Why did they?
Was there any market trend
you?
At the time that kind of spurred that?
There were two market trends. Number one, low interest rates. And so everyone's just out here trying to buy. And number two, and this is actually something so many people are not aware of. So much M&A activity is dictated by some random research report by Bain, Goldman, JP Morgan. He says, social media marketing
is the next thing.
So then the private equity groups go, it is the next thing. Let's now go buy more social media marketing companies. Right? So those two things happened. And so we were approached and I was like, ooh, consolidation time. I just knew.
What did you know when the first emails came in that was like...
No, I think it was after the third email, it's such a short period of time.
Okay.
It's like, oh, that's interesting. These guys are all funded by PE groups and they're all strategics. That's interesting. And then I started doing some research and I did read a report. I think it was by Bain Capital, who had done a research report the year before. It's like, oh, okay, this makes sense now. And so when I realized that, then... I had two decisions to make. One was, do I then begin a process of trying to sell the company, or do we hire a bank?
Okay.
And I got conflicting advice for this, but basically the advice was, if you think you can get over 20 million for your company, like 15, 20 million, you should hire a bank.
Okay.
So then we hired a bank. And the way that we hired a bank was we looked at people who had sold similar companies to us and then we got them to basically pitch us.
Got it.
And that was quite a cool feeling. It was like me going into these offices and like, here is how we can make you rich. I was like, oh my God, say it more. Then we picked a bank and then they ran a process. And the process was they reach out to, so we created like basically a pitch deck. This is actually a very interesting thing. Selling a company is like selling anything. It's just got more zeros.
Yeah.
Like that's just it, right? Selling a company is like selling anything, but it's just got more zeros. So you do have to create a pitch deck. So you do have to create reasons for them to buy. So that's what the bank helped us to do.
Okay. And I then see.
They began a process. They reached out to six companies. Four companies expressed, in fact, all six said express interest. Two of them couldn't afford us. Four of them could. Three of them put in letters of intent. We then went exclusive with one, Brain Labs. It took about 2 months to go through, and then boom, done.
Ooh, I would love to talk about the feeling after.
Yeah. Yeah, so we can talk about that. If you want, we can go into the details, and then we can talk about that.
Okay.
What do you want to do?
Let's talk about the details.
What would be useful to your audience?
Let's do the details first, and then we'll talk about the feeling. Let that be the natural.
So what details do you want to go through?
So I think you've kind of summarized everything, like all of these conversations happened. Were there any sticky points in between there where it was like, okay, this might fall through, or okay, maybe there's, you know, maybe we thought of it differently. I just want to know, in that process, was there any point where there was more deliberation than you expected and timelines?
Or whether there was anything that you would do differently if you were to go through the process again?
So a couple of things I would... If I was selling my company again, there are three things I'd do differently. The first thing is I would have my books done way earlier. Every year I would have hired an accountant to run our books and make sure everything was good. Because those things take time. The second thing was I would have been aware that selling your company and also running your business happens at the same time. So you have to make sure that your numbers don't go down.
That is true.
So there were quite a few times, especially in Jan, Feb, because we sold in May 2022. In Jan and Feb, I was like, boys, the numbers. But I couldn't tell my team why suddenly the CEO was doing sales meetings.
Because you needed to make sure. And it's so funny because it takes time. Like the process takes time from the team, from you on building the business. But then...
and if in that time, if the numbers dip, then that's not like, a good reflection on, on the business, right? So
it's an awkward conversation, but it's not like a terrible conversation.
Yeah, deal breaker. Right? Yeah.
And then, and I must say, I think Brain Labs are... We are an exceptional acquirer.
Yeah.
I think that...
From an experience standpoint, like the entire experience of having to...
Yeah, because, you know, there is this thing in M&A called reneging. They give you the deal, then they say, actually, oh, we just found this on page 87.
There's new stuff that kind of changes suddenly, our original value.
They stuck to it and they kept it.
Oh, that's great.
And I think that was very, very honorable.
How long did it take end to end? First email.
Five months.
Whoa, that was
pretty
quick.
Wait, let me think. 6 months, October. Actually, geez, I just realized it actually took longer than I thought it did. November to April.
Okay, five.
Interesting.
Cool. November to April, and to be honest, it took slightly longer just because of Christmas. And the reason why it was a relatively simple thing, I'll tell you the reason. I think there were two reasons. One was we had a bank who had already sold to Brain Labs before.
So they knew what they required.
And I think generally you pay a premium for experience. Because the bank we used was not the cheapest. But man, they made me sleep well at night.
I see.
Like the guys there, Tristan, Rosie, Lauren, they just, anytime I'd get a call from them, I wouldn't feel stressed.
You'd know they're on your side. You're like, yeah.
Right? Even when we're knee deep in spreadsheets, DD, I'm like, tell me the good news. And I think they were exceptional, exceptional bankers. So those were the details there. But the question was like, what could we have done differently?
Yeah, I think you touched a little bit on that. But yeah, the other bit I was asking was just like, was there any sticky point? But it sounds like it went well, like it was 5 months. Sounds like, yes, the regular process, but because sometimes in these transactions, something you know just what? Comes
yes,
in.
Yes, there was a sticky point. There was a sticky point, and to be honest, I give absolute full credit to my co-founders, and again to Brain Labs, and to the bankers for making this smooth. Because we were idiots, the way that we calculated revenue was dumb. So we calculated revenue as...
gross bookings?
Yeah, like cash revenue. Oh, so if somebody booked a campaign now, even if it was going to launch in 6 months...
You would realize that.
You would realize it here.
Okay. Accruals, yeah.
And then someone told us about accrual.
Yeah.
We're like, what is that?
Yeah.
And what is this new word you're giving us? And then we Google it, and then we found out, yo, our revenue could be 50% of what we said.
Did you have a finance manager? How do you think you could have done that differently?
Having an experienced finance director.
Yeah.
And but did you not have someone?
So we had a finance manager, but really they worked under Ambrose.
Okay. Yeah.
And Ambrose is like insanely smart, insanely clever, but Ambrose is not a finance manager.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So suddenly when you're saying like cash accounting versus accrual accounting, and I remember getting this call from Ambrose and Mitch. They were like, yeah, so it looks like our revenue was like 30% of what we said. It's like, what?
Interesting.
That was really funny.
Interesting.
That was really funny, actually. So the advice
was that a moment of panic?
Because the bank that we used was not panicking, I didn't panic.
Okay. Yeah.
I also think Ambrose and Mitch did an exceptional job of like removing it from me. Because I think after the fact, they were like, yo, we were panicking.
Yeah.
But I was just like, I was like, guys, you take care of the spreadsheet stuff. Mm. I will make sure that the sales of the business are still doing this thing.
Yeah.
Right? And I would be the guy who would kind of paint the picture, really help with all that stuff.
Yeah.
You do the numbers.
Yeah.
And that really, really helped. So that was probably the like hairiest moment, I'd say.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So the big advice to people is like, make sure that, give yourself an annual audit. Like really give yourself an annual audit.
Yeah.
And don't give yourself like some, like give yourself an annual audit from the perspective of an M&A.
An external person. Yeah, like an external person who's looking in.
Yeah.
No, that makes sense. So I don't know if we want to touch on any other areas like during that process, because it was quite quick also. So I would say like after, you know, 14-year-old Tim said to himself, by 30, I need to have crazy money. I need to not have to think about all the stuff. When was the acquisition like a full cash? Was it cash stock? Cash, it was full cash.
Yeah.
So after, you know, you get that alert or you like look in your bank statement. What did that do just kind of for you? What was that experience like?
So I actually think there are two stories to tell here. The first one is, during the process, I documented a lot.
Oh, really?
And I think it was probably the most impactful thing I did.
Like you just wrote or like journaled? Like
I sent voice memos.
Okay.
I sent voice memos to myself. And it's so interesting, like, to relive some of those experiences.
Yeah.
One time you're like, this is amazing. And then you're like, oh, this is taking so long. and you end up just being able to relive that. But in terms of when the money dropped, and I think I've told you the story before, but I'm happy to share it, which is when we announced the company had been acquired, it was everywhere, The Times, BBC, Forbes, and all these places. The money still hadn't been sent, right? And it's like in the process of being sent.
Yeah.
So we're getting all these like congratulations.
Yeah, you're like, the money's not in.
Where is the pesos, right? And what was really funny was all three of us, myself, Ambers, and Mitch, we created new bank accounts. And come to think about it, the logic was quite funny. For me, I was like, okay, at that point I had Monzo and Starling. I was like, right,
that's not gonna
Monzo. If they get like millions,
they're just gonna flag it. Like
they're gonna use it for their funding, right? Right? Oh, guys, we have Series B now. So I'm like, no way is that happening. So I got like, I got Santander.
You know? You're like, yeah.
I know they've been there for time. So anyway, so I got that. Ambrose, I think, got a Santander. Mitch got a Lloyds. And we're just like walking around Old Street because we've announced the deal, but we're walking around Farringdon.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're walking around Farringdon and we're just like refreshing. And we're like, okay, so what's going to happen? What's going to happen? And then Mitchell refreshes his and he just starts shouting. He's like,
is that the moment it became real for you?
Yeah. And then Ambrose refreshed like 30 seconds after. He's and then I refresh, and my still showing 0000. And I'm like, oh my God. I am checking every number. I'm like, 0, 0, 3, 3. I'm like, I'm thinking, please, God, don't tell me that I'm giving my account number suit code to some random.
Oh my God.
I was stressing. And then I refreshed, and then I started shouting. Yeah. Oh my God. And here's the crazy thing about like documenting, yeah. Right? It's actually, Mitchell was taking a video of this, mm-hmm. and I actually have it on my phone, and it's just me, like, looking at my phone mm-hmm. and being like, just shouting and, like, jumping
you
up
really
and down.
The
jumping.
Moment.
I'm
I
like,
love
oh
that.
My God. Oh my. And all I'm just saying is, like, wow. Like, that's all I'm saying. And that moment, I am really happy that I documented it because, you know, and this is not just with like selling a business. It can be with anything. It can be with having a baby. It can be with having a wedding. Like as time goes on, the memories fade.
Yeah.
And it's so important to document them in the most like primitive way. Mm. Like not just kind of like some stylized
way.
Yeah,
just like, as it was.
Yeah. Like us in Farringdon popping champagne, mm-hmm. being like, oh, and then like spraying champagne and saying, wow, and like all of that stuff. That was a feeling which I would never forget. And I think, again, it doesn't have to be
exactly that. Yeah,
you doing a business.
Yeah,
it can be you getting that job that you really wanted. Yeah. It can be, you know what? One of my good friends, she did something amazing, which was she went on a date with someone,
mm-hmm.
and like literally in that like after that date, she was like, "I think I'm going to marry this person." Mm. Right. She did a video of herself just being like, oh my God, oh my God, he's so amazing, da da da, oh my God, blah blah. And then at her wedding.
That was so cute. Aww, I was like, it was so cute if they ended up married. Like, that is
and then at her wedding, they played it. And I cried.
Yeah.
Because I was just like,
what are the odds of that?
Those moments,
I mean, you know, you could record many, definitely. But at least if that one.
At least that one, right?
No, but I agree. I think it's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, so for me, that was how it felt. And I think the other thing that's very interesting is what I call like the four stages of exits. Mm. Right? So when you sell a company, or at least for me, I think I went through basically four emotional stages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The first stage was like, what? Like, this is mental. Yeah. Like, this is mad. Like me from like Old Kent Road.
Yeah.
And then there was a bit of it, which was like, of course, me from O'Carroll.
Yeah, right? Okay.
And then the second bit was like when your world has changed, mm-hmm. but like the outside world hasn't changed.
Yeah.
So I remember like 2 weeks afterwards, I went to Sainsbury's and I was expecting like a choir. I'm like, yo, the boy is here.
He's arrived. And
where's
everyone is
throne?
Just like, sorry, I just
roll out
the
red
bananas.
Carpet.
Exactly. And they're buying freaking avocados. I'm like, what are you doing, mate? Right? But that's so interesting because it's one of those things. I hear this from a lot of sports people as well. It's like after they won something incredible.
Yeah, even like actors and actresses, especially the Emmy. Like once you get the gold, like after you're just like.
And then you're like,
the world is the same.
Yeah.
You know,
I've lived all my life for this.
For this and the world is same. And then the third one is actually where you basically have to like, this is going to sound weird, but it's basically you have to readjust to your new level of wealth.
Yeah. Mm.
And so what I mean by that is like, it took me an extremely long time. This is going to sound like rich people problems, but it's not meant to be. But it took me an extremely long time to basically adjust my mindset to like having money. So like, I remember we took a flight to Bali afterwards. And it took me like a month of agonizing to be like, okay, are we flying business or economy?
Yeah.
And I got my spreadsheet out. I was like, okay, so if you do this, but I still have this money, so that's okay. But then like proper agonizing over it. And I think as with anyone, you have to readjust yourself
image. Yeah, it's like in the grand scheme of things, is
exactly
that the thing that,
exactly.
Yeah.
And then the fourth one is actually going, okay, this is who I am now.
Yeah.
Now, how do I act in the world? How do I behave in the world, right? Which can mean very simply that your approach money to friendships is also quite different, where you don't see yourself just like so much as a like a transaction.
Yeah.
Because I think that was a big thing where you're just like, oh, yeah, like, do you guys want to come to my dinner? I'll pay for it. Oh, do it. I'll do it. And you only see this like an ATM.
Yeah.
Right? And you have to almost be like, well, who am I independent of the money?
Of this.
And so those were the four stages.
Did you get wealth managers starting to sell?
Oh, mate. Those sharks. Absolute sharks.
Like, you didn't know me before, but
what I would say, though, again, yes, I did, and I didn't really go with any of them. But it does feel nice.
Yeah, I bet. Nice.
They're like, oh, you know, Tim, you're one of our value people. Oh, now value? Now value? Yeah.
Interesting. Anyway, interesting. Yeah. So how much did it sell for? How much did
you get? Oh, that is not a number that I make publicly. But what we say is it was tens of millions.
Okay.
It was less... It was less than 100 and more than 10.
Okay. Ooh, wow. That's not giving it up. That's like a wide range.
We'll
take it. We'll take it.
But I'll tell you actually the reason why, very quickly, because I know you just said rapper. But I'll tell you the reason why often people don't disclose numbers publicly.
Okay, tell us.
And often people are like, well, why not? The reason why is this. Often, if a company is buying you, they're not just buying you. They're buying a bunch of other companies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so what can happen is if you say your value out or you say your multiples out or something like that, what can happen is
can
any future
another, right. Okay.
Any future companies they want to buy
they just
can be
use
like,
that as
oh,
an anchor. Yeah.
You bought this for this. And like, we're bigger than them or we have a bigger team than them. Or just like some absolute crap.
Okay.
So often that's the reason why you're not asked to make public because like you're actually impeding.
Yeah.
The future growth of your buyer, and unless you hate your buyer,
why would you
there's no reason to do that.
Yeah, cool. Thank you so much, Tim. Honestly, really appreciate you coming here, sharing your authentic story with us today. Thank you.
Yeah,
we're good.
So I think what would be lovely, we end with all our guests with this. It's two questions.
Yeah.
So the first, there's a time machine.
Yeah.
Involved. So now Tim is going back to the beginning of FanBytes.
Okay.
You've got 1 minute. The machine opens. You see Tim. Probably at that point, just when he's making that decision, what do you tell him? 1 minute.
Don't let your ego get in the way. Make sure that you hire more experienced people as soon as you can and also take bigger risks.
I love that. I love that. I love that. Fantastic. And then the second, for any operator, someone who's ruminating on an idea, who's kind of thinking about stuff, especially for someone who's younger and someone who doesn't probably have the background. You know, now when you kind of think of fans, like, have you done it before? Mm. But like, you have to do it first time. What will you tell them?
Start very small and have relatively small goals.
Okay.
Love that.
Why did you say that?
Small goals are more achievable. And I would much rather hit certain goals, build enough evidence that I'm the sort of person that can hit those goals, and then over time make those goals bigger.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Tim. It's so lovely to have you. And thank you everyone for joining us as well. So I guess till next time.
Thank you.
Peace. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Startup Leap, TSL for short. Leave a review, tell us what you think of this episode on all of our platforms at the Startup Leap Pod. Do you have a question? Ask us and we'll ask our guests. Go to thestartupleap.io. See you next time.